Evan Kimball chose to be an organ donor when he got his license at age 16. Last October, Evan was killed in a car crash. He was 18. That donation has turned into an even greater gift because of the effort of his parents to get more people to register as donors.
It means, you know, it's really the only thing that keeps us upright.
Through our grief and our healing, we're just trying to inspire others to just have some forethought. No one wants to talk about their mortality.
Right.
But you never know when God's going to call you home.
I'm Lester Graham. Today on Stateside, how one young man's decision to become an organ donor gave five others a chance at life. But first, the city of Detroit is trying to help people who have criminal records clear up those past mistakes in order to get a job. Butch Hollowell is Corporation Counsel for the City of Detroit, and he joins us now. This effort is called Project Clean Slate. You're working with Detroit residents to expunge their records so they can get back into the workforce. How many residents might be eligible for this kind of help?
Well, approximately 70,000, if you can believe it, are eligible for this program. We also have approximately 3,000 to 5,000 returning citizens per year. So this Project Clean Slate is an initiative of the city's law department where we've recruited 100 lawyers and 100 law students to represent eligible applicants for expungement. These are nonviolent expungements for free. Typically in the market costs about $1,500 to $2,500, but we would do it for free. These are volunteer lawyers in exchange for the applicant to sign up for the city's workforce development agency so that we can help them in getting job ready.
Right. Of course, unemployment in Detroit is chronically twice that of the state and national average, so it's really needed. And a lot of employers are reluctant to hire someone who has a criminal record, but some of them have been reaching out. I mean, some companies have gone and to ex-offenders, giving them a second chance. How successful have those efforts been in Detroit?
That process is underway, and I have to say we have to give employers some credit for that. While we know that it's illegal under Michigan law for an employer to ask for whether a job applicant has been arrested, but you can ask if they've had a felony which has resulted in a conviction. There are some limitations on that. That being said, studies show that it continues to be a major impediment to employment. We've had some employers who have become friendly, let's call it this way. They've been open for bringing in those who've had a brush with the law. But more than that, we had 673 people, 673 that stood in line starting at 6 in the morning.
The program this is the recent recruitment project on a Saturday you held.
It was a recent recruitment. It was on Saturday the 4th. At Fellowship Chapel on the west side, and we just had no idea what kind of a turnout it would be, but it was pretty extraordinary. And I think what that tells you is that people are desperate to get their records clean so that they can take a step up, get a better job, fully integrate into society, and we hope this is a good step in the right direction.
Where the heck are you getting all this free legal help?
We just asked and we got. I started going around to other stakeholders that I've worked with in the past, the NAACP, the ACLU, Wolverine Bar Association, Straker Bar, the Deltas, and then I went to the law schools, Wayne, Cooley, and it was really interesting with Michigan State. Daniel Manville, who is an assistant professor there, and he's also director of their civil rights clinic, I hadn't been able to get him, but then he came. He came to the actual expungement conference, and he gave me his card. I said, come on up on stage with the judges, and he said, and by the way, he says, not only will Michigan State participate, but I have done time myself, and so I can share my story. I put him at the microphone right away.
Wow.
So it was pretty powerful, and people really vibed with him. We actually filmed a video. So if you go to DetroitMI.gov/Project Clean Slate. We used the chief of the criminal division's courtroom, Judge Tim Kenny, who's been fabulous in helping us put this together. We did a mock expungement. So we actually went through what does a motion look like to take down the apprehension that people will have about what do I have to go through. We wanted people to see, well, what's the judge going to ask me? And typically what they want to know is, what have you been doing with your life? And you know, do you have a family? Are you going to your meetings? Have you been trying to get a job? And here you have so many people that have said, you know, I'm stuck in this $10 an hour job. I've got a family now. I've done my time. I really want to get integrated into society and do better. And the stories are compelling. I think this is what we ought to be doing. I think the statute is a little stingy. Frankly, it's a new statute which says that it went into effect in January of 2015. Says that if you have one felony and two misdemeanors, then you're eligible to either get the one felony taken off or the two misdemeanors taken off.
I was looking at a list here of convictions of offenses that you won't be eligible. There's quite a long length here.
So
list. You're being picky about who's eligible, who's not. I'm surprised the courts have been so supportive of this. I mean, this adds to their caseload. It's not like they don't have a big caseload already.
No, the courts have been enormously supportive of this. In fact, I mean, when you look at the Chief Judge Kenney has helped plan all along. We have the Chief Judge of the 36th District Court, Nancy Blunt, also on stage and answering questions with us was Judge Ed Yule, Judge Kenny King. The courts are universally, I would say, supportive of this. And so what we, you know, you've said it, you know, we do have those exceptions. If you've got a DUI or if your sentence was for something where you could serve life in prison, you're not eligible. But the thing that kept coming up at the conference and something that we're hoping the legislature would reconsider is that you're not eligible for traffic offenses. And I'd say a good 35-40% of the people who came, you know, have something like a traffic offense on the record. Now, I can see if you're applying for a job as a cab driver or a truck driver or something like that, but maybe as this project moves on, we get more testimony, more data, we can ask for an amendment to the statute. But as is, I think we're off to a good start. And again, we make sure that people sign up for the workforce training if they want the free legal representation.
All right, let's get down to brass tacks. How could someone sign up for Project Clean Slate?
Go straight to the website, which is detroit.gov/Project Clean Slate. So that's detroit.gov/Project Clean Slate.
That's Butch Hollowell. He's Corporation Counsel for the City of Detroit and one of the coordinators of Project Clean Slate. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
Hockey legend Gordie Howe has died. He was 88 years old. Howe played pro hockey longer than anyone else and remains Mr. Hockey to generations of fans. Michigan Radio Steve Carmody has this appreciation.
Gordie Howe played hockey with an intensity he learned as a boy in Saskatoon during the Depression. In his 2014 autobiography, Howe wrote about playing for his school team, not on the right wing where generations of hockey fans were used to seeing him, but as a goalie. Howe credited his time in the net for making him ambidextrous. The ability to shoot equally well from the left and the right made Gordie Howe one of the greatest scorers in the history of the National Hockey League. By 1946, 18-year-old Gordie Howe was playing for the Detroit Red Wings. During the next quarter century, Howe's ability to score and his willingness to fight led to 4 Stanley Cup trophies, 6 National Hockey League scoring titles, and being named the league's most valuable player a half dozen times. Gordie Howe also racked up more than 2,000 minutes in the penalty box. In an interview for the Biography Channel, Howe talked about how he used his physical strength to intimidate other players on the ice.
If you learn to play a little rough and shape the rules a little bit, sometimes you get a little more respect. And respect gives you more room. And you get a little more room to maneuver, then you'll be a better hockey player.
The hockey life did leave its scars. Broken bones, hundreds of stitches. The game took a physical toll on Gordie Howe. By his own count, his nose was broken 14 times. In the 1950 playoffs, he suffered a skull fracture that almost killed him. Gordie Howe retired in 1971 and was elected to the Hall of Fame in 1972. But by 1973, Gordie Howe was back on the ice. An offer to play alongside his sons and the fledgling World Hockey Association lured Gordie Howe out of retirement, and the legend held his own, skating against men half his age. Gordie Howe didn't hang up his skates for good until 1980, when he was 52 years old. Howe still holds several NHL records, including most seasons played, most regular season games played, and most seasons with 20 or more goals. He's also the only man to play in the NHL in five different decades. He even played in one minor league hockey game when he was 70. In 1998, the Hockey News ranked Gordie Howe as the third best player in history, though many on that list say Gordie Howe was the best of all time. Michigan radio sports commentator John Ubakin says Gordie Howe is the greatest sports icon in Michigan history.
In hockey, he's Babe Ruth. Yes, Babe Ruth's records have been surpassed, and so have Gordie Howe's by Wayne Gretzky in his case. But he was truly, and it's trademarked, Mr. Hockey. And no one else in the state of Michigan can come close to that icon status.
In his autobiography, Howe wrote that when he was asked why he played so long, he would reply, he never stopped loving the game. Many years after he stopped playing, his fans never stopped loving him. I'm Steve Carmody, Michigan Radio News.
Later this hour on Stateside, Michigan celebrates the 150th birthday of the state's most iconic pop. That's coming up.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We're visiting Michigan's oldest opera house. The Croswell Opera House in Adrian is 150 years old. With me is Jerry Ryder, the artistic director. Let's talk a little bit about the history. How did the opera house get started?
Well, actually, Charles Croswell, who did go on to become governor of the state, really just sort of had it in his mind that he wanted to have a theater here in this community. So back in the early 1860s, in fact, he started gathering the people to raise the money and build the building. So it took some securing of land, obviously, and those kinds of things. And it took until 1865 was when the building started. And then it opened for business, in fact, in March of 1866.
It originally wasn't called the Croswell Opera House.
Right. Originally, it was called the Union Hall, and union in the sense of it being the gathering place for people in the community.
Tell me what kind of events were held here in the 19th century.
Okay, so all kinds of things. Poultry sales and other kinds of animal shows were brought in. At one point, there were wolves in cages and dogs in cages and in the auditorium, but mostly it was a place for things like lectures, plays being put on by folks from the community, as well as really the most nationally known or largest acts of the day came to the Croswell.
Right. You've had some pretty notable speakers and performers here. Can you give us just a couple of names we might recognize from the 19th century?
Oh, sure. Ralph Waldo Emerson spoke here, Frederick Douglass, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Really, all of the suffragettes were here. And then performers, Edwin Booth, the
brother of the assassin, yes.
Exactly. In fact, they came here, the Booth family came here just a couple of years after the assassination, performing in the exact same play that Lincoln was watching when he was shot. So very interesting.
And Susan B. Anthony, I understand, was here, one of the suffragettes you mentioned.
Yes.
Now, when movies started to become popular, venues such as the Croswell Opera House all around the nation suddenly found some real competition from movie theaters. What happened here?
It became time for a major renovation, in fact, changing the size and shape of the balcony to make room for towers that would hold the pipes for an organ. The organ itself took a lot of time to raise the money to install that. So what we see now at the Croswell is actually the result of that major, major renovation in the early 1920s.
And it ran movies just to keep up, I assume.
It did. In fact, several of the largest movie companies of the day owned and operated the Croswell leading up to the late 1960s.
And I see from your marquee you still run some films.
Yeah, once in a while we do. It's certainly not the mainstay of our business, but we do shows on Saturday mornings for kids, as well as once in a while something special drives us to put together a movie and put it out there.
When did you start hosting performances again?
Well, we actually are continuously operating. So the movies were going on, and then as the building was saved from demolition, was slated to become a parking lot, the community really rallied together, and in 1968, Adrian High School put their school musical on at the Croswell, and from that point forward, we've been producing shows all year round.
What kind of shows do we see now, today?
So what we produce are plays and musicals. We really consider ourselves kind of a regional quality professional theater, even though we're doing this with community folks for the most part. So something that was on Broadway 3 or 4 years ago might be at the Croswell now, as well as some of the more classical plays and musicals.
So these are community performers. Do any of them go on to make a career out of this?
Oh my gosh, it's really what we are kind of known for now. People who are on Broadway currently in all aspects, performing, hair, makeup, costumes, wig design, scenic design, Tony nominations, all of that is what's happening with people who have performed on our stage. And that doesn't take away from the fact that it's up community people as well. Parents and children are in shows together, and lots of great stuff going on here.
You started a fundraising campaign last year. What was the reason for that?
Well, a big reason is really to help maintain and secure the building's next 150 years of history. Knob and tube wiring in our basement that was dirt floor, all kinds of life safety issues, as well as bringing our production technology up to the current century and technology.
Jerry Ryder is the artistic director of the Croswell Opera House, and Adrian celebrating 150 years this year.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Where I live, we're getting a lot of RV traffic right now. I live less than 18 miles from the Michigan International Speedway, and believe me, race fans are rolling in. This Sunday, it's the site of the Firekeepers Casino 400. With NASCAR in the state, we thought we'd take a moment and recognize one of the inductees into the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Benny Parsons was a racer and a broadcaster. He was from North Carolina, so, you know, racing was probably already in his blood. But he moved to Detroit, where he worked as a taxicab driver for the Metropolitan Cab Company, which his father owned. Joining us now is Matt Yocum. He's a Michigan native and a longtime NASCAR reporter who is currently working for Fox Sports. So you worked with Benny Parsons. First, how does a guy like that go from a cab on the streets of Detroit to the oval track?
Well, you know, it's like anything. And when you're a young guy, girls and cars, and a race car just so happened to come in on a tow truck, and that, boom, that flipped the light switch for Benny Parsons. And from that point forward, what he wanted to be from the early 60s on was he wanted to be a race car driver, a champion race car driver. And that passion that he had for every area of his life, boom, that ignited in racing, and he did. I mean, he's in the Michigan Motorsports Hall of Fame, and he was just announced that he's going to be inducted into the NASCAR Hall of Fame, which a great accomplishment.
So for those of us not familiar with his place in racing history, tell us what he did to earn this spot in the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
You know, there are guys that made it in because, oh, they had, you know, 40 wins and they had a championship, or and maybe they had a Daytona 500 win, but they didn't have a championship. But for Benny, it was his body of work behind the wheel, but also in the broadcast booth. When you look at the respect that he generated from his peers, go back to 1973 when he won the championship. Last race of the year, Rockingham, North Carolina, involved in a crash, ripped the whole right side of the car off.
Actually, now, we've got a little tape from Benny Parsons from the NASCAR Hall of Fame's video. So here's Benny explaining what happened.
I tried to turn under him, and when I did, I just caught him with the right side of my car and ripped the whole right side off of it.
Ripped the whole right side off of it. So what did they do?
Something that would be unheard of almost in today's racing world. It doesn't matter what type of discipline. When that car came in, members from a bunch of different teams, I mean, it was like a sea, a rainbow color of crew shirts, because so many different crew members from other teams jumped in and started repairing. I mean, Benny came back from the hospital, and he looks over there, and they're fixing his car. So that way he could get back out, log some laps, enough so he could clinch the championship. But I think if anything says respect from your peers, that certainly would be one of those great examples.
That's an amazing story. Of course, you know, he retired in 88, went into broadcasting. People liked what he brought to TV. What made him different?
Well, I think if you go back and you look at Benny, always had the personality. he could walk into a room and he made you feel like you were the only person in the room, and he was totally focused in his conversation with you. And I think that's one thing when you look also with the fans. He helped change television, the way it was broadcast. You know, you think back, you know, whether it's Jim McKay with the polyester ABC Sports blazer or Chris Economaki or whomever, when Benny came in, he had that little bit of a Southern drawl, and he had his personality. It really warmed up the TV audience. And there's so many fans today that really, probably 50-50, some that know his entire career involved in racing, but there are some that just knew him from television. And his television work alone was enough to get him in the Hall of Fame, I feel. But when you look at his driving career, Lester, I mean, it was so impressive. He drove for a middle tier team most of his career, but yet he was able still, because of his talent, he won the Daytona 500. He won the World 600. Two of the three crown jewel events in stock car auto racing he won. And he won a race here at Michigan driving for a car that was sponsored by a local company, Melling Tool and Die. And through his association, this is the one thing about Benny. It's like you throw a rock in the lake. And that ripple effect, and that really was Benny Parsons, because he said to Harry Melling in Jackson, Michigan, you know what? I know somebody that you should really get involved in. I think you could help their program. And that person was Bill Elliott and the Elliott family. And because of that association, Bill Elliott's career took off, winning the Daytona 500 twice, winning a championship. And now he, too, is in the NASCAR Hall of Fame. So there's just so much to Benny where you need an hour-long special just to bring up all of the things that he brought to the table and how he changed the sport of stock car racing.
Of course, Benny Parsons died of lung cancer in 2007. I wonder what he would think about entering the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
You know, we talked a lot of, you know, our road trips. We traveled together when we worked together at NBC, and we would sit next to each other. And it was funny. We had our own little routine, because especially when he was sick and he was going through his cancer treatments, we'd get on the plane. I would get his Diet Coke. I would get his meal. And we'd sit down and we'd just start talking about whether it's the day's events. You know, we would talk about how NASCAR needed a place to showcase the founders of the sport, the people, you know, with their sweat. They helped build this sport through the different stages, the different eras. And I think he would have been so humbled to have been voted in. And for, you know, like I said before, with him, it's his body of work, whether it's behind the wheel or in the broadcast booth.
Matt Yocum is a Michigan native and longtime NASCAR reporter. You'll see him on Fox Sports covering the Firekeepers Casino 400 on Sunday at the Michigan International Speedway. We've been talking about Benny Parsons, who will be inducted into the NASCAR Hall of Fame in January of 2017. Enjoy the race this weekend.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on. And traffic may be a little bit rough for you getting home, but that's a good sign that we've got a lot of people coming into this area, the Irish Hills. I just wish that, like, prehistoric forest and you know, Stagecoach Stop were still in operation so they could see what it was like here in the 70s and early 80s. It's a great area, and it's definitely coming back. And when you look at the campers coming in, I was following so many today. I'm thinking, man, this is going to be a great crowd.
Well, those attractions you were talking about in the Irish Hills, days gone by, my friend. Days gone by. So,
yep.
All right. Thanks much.
All right. Thanks, Lester.
If you have a driver's license, you might have chosen to be an organ donor. In the lower right-hand corner in red, it will say donor next to a red heart. Evan Kimball chose to be a donor when he got his license at age 16. Last October, Evan was killed in a car crash. He was 18. His parents, Lydia and Ward Kimball, used something called directed donation as the doctors were recovering his organs, and they join me now. First, tell me a little bit about Evan.
Oh, he was a community giver. He was a Little League coach. He officiated three sports. He gave back to his youth programs.
He was a 4-H pig farmer.
Exactly.
Chicken farmer.
Loved his pigs.
We wanted him to. We wanted both of our sons to be well-rounded young men, and he was an actor. He acted in the school for the high school, and he was he gave back to the community in many different ways, but sports was one of them. And he also went down with the other boys in his age group and class, and they would go down and they would read to the young kids in kindergarten, first grade, whatever.
Lydia, would you explain to us what directed donation means?
We actually reached out to family and friends and asked if they had anyone that they knew that was in need of a transplant. We received 7 names at that time, and we offered those to the coordinators at Gift of Life, and they worked with doctors to see, you know, who would be a candidate. 4 were perfect matches, and LB received the gift of Evan's heart.
Right. LB LaForce is on the phone with us. LB, I understand this weekend that you and Mr. and Mrs. Kimball are going to the Transplant Games of America, which is being held in Cleveland starting this weekend. What is the Transplant Games?
It's basically kind of like the Olympics for all organ transplant recipients. And you're allowed to compete and do different events. And it's a good way to show others, you know, what transplant patients really are capable of, and to honor your donors.
So what does it mean to you that LB will be able to participate in this game because of Evan's decision to be a donor?
Well, it probably speaks to Evan's strong heart to begin with. And
right, he was an athlete.
Yeah. You know, and it speaks to how strong his heart was, and then LB's resilience and all this, and how he's bounced back and
worked hard.
Yeah.
Worked hard to do this, yes.
Because he's a kind of a big deal, right, LB?
So how many people did receive organs?
5.
5 total.
5.
And two gained sight.
We are now working towards helping 4,444 people add that little donor heart to their license. I just encourage people to pull the license from their wallet, because so many times they think they did, or like you said, if it's not there in that corner, you are not registered. So we have a link established actually in Evan's honor.
And that's not just for Michigan. We have a national link as well.
So what does it mean to you that you've inspired that many people to actually consider the same gift that Evan just instinctively did when he was 16?
Well, it means, you know, it's really the only thing that keeps us upright. And one of the big things that I've been telling everybody is it keeps us upright and off medication. You know, we're not...
Through our grief and our healing, we're just trying to inspire others to just have some forethought. Nobody wants to talk about their mortality.
Right.
But you never know when God's going to call you home. And there are 3,500 people just in the state of Michigan currently on the transplant list.
In need of some organ.
So,
now, how did you guys know LB?
These are the directed donations that we did were, we just put out a blanket, call for help to anyone, friends or family that needed help. And Evan had walked onto the baseball team at Aquinas and had made the team at Aquinas in Grand Rapids. And basically, LB's dad is best friends with one of the ballplayers' dads on Aquinas' team.
They went to church together, and so that name came to us through Cameron and Coach Greenslate. And Ward made a phone call to LB and said, "I need your information." So we passed that to the coordinators, and that was the perfect match.
LB, what does it mean to you to be a recipient of Evan's heart?
Well, I guess first and foremost, you know, it's an honor that that they gave me this opportunity. And, you know, it just means the whole world to me.
I imagine. Did you ever meet Evan?
I unfortunately did not, no.
So do you think this is going to be a lifelong pursuit for you guys to continue to try to get people to register as donors? And you know, when are you going to be satisfied that you've done enough in honor of Evan?
I don't know that there's ever enough.
Yeah. The need is so great, and no one talks about it. You know, that no one talks about this. And, you know, so, I mean, there's a need, and as long as there's a need, I think that that's probably what will drive us.
We've been speaking to Lydia and Ward Kimball. Their son, Evan, registered to become an organ donor. That donation has turned into an even greater gift because of the effort to get more people to register as donors. And we spoke to LB LaForce, a recipient of one of those donations. They'll all be participating in the Transplant Games of America starting this weekend in Cleveland. Thanks very much for sharing your story.
Yes, we actually have a link established in Evan's honor, giftoflifemichigan.org/go/Evan.
Here. Certainly, you can look for him on michiganradio.org.
Awesome.
LB, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Michigan legislature has approved a nearly $55 billion budget. Republican legislators patted themselves on the back for getting the budget done on time, increased spending in some key areas, despite dealing with an unexpected shortfall in revenues. For the most part, the Democrats were not happy. Joining us by Skype to talk about the budget is Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Susan, a lot of Democrats have voted against aspects of the budget. What are they concerned about?
Well, Democrats are chiefly concerned about the cuts to infrastructure. Originally, they were going to spend $165 million to try and take care of some of the issues that we've so tragically seen play out in Flint with water infrastructure and lead lines. And also, as usual, they're very concerned about the education budgets. The spending on education, while it's gone up, hasn't kept up with the rate of inflation. And a lot of schools across the state have been making cuts for years.
I'm glad you brought up that $165 million. Governor Snyder wanted money for infrastructure improvements. He got about $5 million instead of $165 million. Ken, the governor says he's still politically relevant. Does the legislature realize that?
Well, he's always struggled in terms of his relationship with the legislature and even the Republican majorities. You know, that's not really new news. I think the $165 million that got reduced to $5 million, it's mostly a message from the legislature that they don't think the state's ready yet for the magnitude of that sort of investment. So I wouldn't necessarily see it as a no, we're not going to look at infrastructure, meaning basically we're talking about water and sewer underground pipelines. It's more of, you know, we see the need in Flint, but the case statewide, we need a little bit more information about where and when and what the priorities are and how we're going to do it. I don't see it as a final no-no. I see it as more, we need more information.
Susan, there was money for Flint in this budget, but there's also already some grumbling about, you know, is it the emergency? Is this overblown? Should we be doing all of this? Is there enough political will in the legislature to find the money to deal with all of the fallout that the lead contamination is causing?
I think it's going to be increasingly difficult to get more money to deal with Flint as, you know, we get further along into the year. Obviously, the legislature is broken for summer, so we're not going to see any more movement for a while. But there are a lot of concerns that the money will not be spent correctly, how much is really required, and then you have the factor of what the federal government will or will not do. That's kind of a parallel discussion because they have a role in fixing things as well.
Ken, in your past life as Senate Majority Leader, you've shepherded a budget through. What did you think of the budget priorities for this year?
Well, when I was Senate Majority Leader and Granholm was governor, we had budget challenges for four straight years because it was during the economic downturn during the first decade of the century. But I characterize this particular budget as both kind of quiet and tight. The two big issues really that had budget implications kind of were issues in and of themselves, and that's Flint and Detroit Public Schools. And there's the first payment here for the debt for Detroit Public Schools in this budget, and a lot of money for the Flint water crisis to deal with that. But other than that, it was a pretty quiet budget and pretty tight. As you pointed out, revenue hasn't materialized the way a lot of people thought. There are some small increases here for education and other things, but the emphasis here would be small. Revenue sharing is flat. Quiet and tight is how I characterize this budget.
Well, the Detroit Public Schools was a little controversial. I mean, there's less money than originally proposed by the Senate. They're allowing uncertified teachers to teach in Detroit public schools. There's no limits on charter schools, which makes more competition for the public schools. Some Republicans are grumbling about what is being sent to make the Detroit schools right. Too much money, they say. What's your assessment, both of you, if you would answer that question? Let's start with you, Susan.
Well, this was a Herculean task for the legislature. The House and Senate plans were radically different. The governor does not have very much political capital to spend, and you had a district that was teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. So something had to be done. This was a less than ideal option, you know, starting with the fact that not enough money was allocated as far as what the emergency manager said was required. The big question is, will this do the trick? Can the school district get back its financial footing, which it struggled with for decades? And more importantly, are kids going to be able to learn? Will they be able to get rid of the rats and the mold and the huge infrastructure problems in the school that are making kids sick?
Right.
Those are issues that were not really addressed.
Let me interject just for a second, because this is being called by some a bailout, a rescue. Others say it's not nearly enough for a bailout or a rescue. This will just let us skate by for a little longer. Ken?
I characterize this as a very expensive Band-Aid. What the legislature did for Detroit is just two things. It basically eliminates the current debt, which I guess that's the bailout, and it returns control to a locally elected school board in the near future. That's all it really does, and it doesn't solve or address the fundamentals that are driving that into that particular district into a lot of problems. And it's complicated, but, you know, it doesn't deal with quality and academic achievement, the things that parents care about. So that's why I think this is a hugely expensive Band-Aid, and there's no guarantee. In fact, we're going to be back at this table here in the not-too-distant future, in my opinion.
Susan, is that right?
I agree. I don't think that the fundamental issues have been solved. I don't think it's enough money to solve the financial end. And I agree with Ken that in terms of academics and safety for children, those things were put way on the back burner, and that's all that parents care about.
Susan Demas is publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. This week, Detroit has been celebrating Verner's 150th anniversary. The celebration winds up tomorrow. And joining us to talk about the iconic company, which started with ginger ale, is Keith Wunderlich, who is a curator of Verner Collectibles. I saw a Metro Times article, by the way, that showed photos of your basement. It's a real museum of all things Verner's. How'd you get started on that?
Well, I love Detroit history and all things Detroit, but especially Detroit products and food products. And so a long time ago, 35, 40 years ago, as I started collecting little pieces of Detroit food memorabilia, potato chip cans from all the potato chip companies, Sanders items, Stroh's items, a bunch of different brewery things like that, as well as Atlas Beverages, Faygo, and Verner's. And then one day I was rummaging around my parents' garage. I found a big box of Verner's bottles that used to be returnable, and then the law had changed, and I asked if I could have them, and they said, of course, and all of a sudden I had like 50 Verner's things, and so that outnumbered everything else, and I decided I would just concentrate strictly on Verner's.
Well, you could probably get 10 cents a bottle for that now.
Now I probably could, yeah, or maybe even more.
Tell us a little bit about the history of Verner's. Who made it and why?
Well, James Verner was a pharmacist, and all pharmacies had a soda fountain. And when he was a teenager, he worked at a pharmacy called Higbee and Stearns. And while he was there, and of course they had a soda fountain, he was messing around with a ginger ale formula. Never could get it the way that he wanted it. It was always like way too strong, just undrinkable. While he was there, the Civil War broke out, and he enlisted and went away for 4 years to the Civil War. When he came back to Detroit, he opened up his own pharmacy and went and retrieved his can of extract from the other drugstore, opened it up, and all of a sudden it was perfect. And so it was that 4 years of the Civil War and aging for that 4 years that made Verner's drinkable and also kind of gave it that special taste.
For a long time, they said aged 4 years
exactly.
In wood. It was a wooden barrel then that he was storing
it in? Correct,
yeah,
oak barrel. And the factory was full of those barrels and a very, very concentrated beverage.
I was surprised about the huge marketing effort, the variety of posters and other material over the years. I mean, for a regional brand, it was pretty astonishing, the marketing effort they made. Why do you think the company went to those kinds of lengths?
It's a great question because every time I think that I've seen all the Verner's items, you know, I see a picture that's got 10 things that I've never seen before. And it's incredible the amount of things that they had and really good artwork. I mean, they had fantastic artists working for them. You know, I think a lot of it was because Verner's became really, really popular in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And that was such a great time for advertising, a great time for art. And it just really blew up during those times with the amount of great advertising that they had.
Now, this celebration of Verner's has included all kinds of events, including an exhibit at Detroit's Historical Museum. Tell me a little bit about that.
There's going to be a relatively large chunk of my collection that's going to be on display at the Historical Museum. They came to my house and put little stickers on everything they wanted, and so packed it up, took it down there, and so that'll be there for people to see. They have some things in their collection as well, but we have lots of other things going on there. For kids, we've got the Verner's Gnome is going to be there live in person. For adults, we've got historical presentations. And then for everybody, at the end of the day, we're going to try to break the record for the most people drinking pop at the same time. And we were lucky enough to get James Verner the 5th and 6th to come visit us. They're going to give us a toast and start off the big drink. And hopefully if we can get over 1,000 people, we can break a record.
Among the events is a showing of the film Made in the Motor City, the history of Detroit's iconic brands. It's produced by my friend Bill Kubota. How key is Verner's history within that film?
There's a whole section about Verner's that's a very special section of that film. He also talks about Faygo and Better Made Chips. And he goes over those famous brands.
Everything
that made
you
Detroit
used to collect.
Well, and all the things that really, I think, help make Detroit what it is and the things that people remember. I mean, when you think back, you remember Verner's. You remember the Faygo song. You remember Better Made and New Era Potato Chips. Those are the kinds of things that are childhood memories and I think are really special and make that film special too.
So Verner's is no longer an independent company. Who owns it, and has the Verner's ginger ale changed since ownership changed?
Dr. Pepper Snapple Group is the owner of the Verner's brand now, and they've been absolutely fantastic. They're a big part of the celebration as well, very supportive, and in fact even developed 150th logo and put it on the cans and bottles now that you can buy at the stores to help recognize the event. And they've been great. Now, Verner's used to be, and you told me you were from Illinois and you didn't grow up drinking Verner's, and so it's not really a favorite. You kind of have to grow a taste to Verner's. So the formula was toned down a little bit to make it more popular to a broader mass of people, but it still has that carbonation that always shocks people. You pour a glass of Verner's and you watch it, and about 2 inches over the glass, it's bubbling up with Verner's there. But it's still, it's still a very unique ginger ale.
So why is it so special to people in Michigan?
I think everybody has a Verner's story that's not just about the pop. I mean, some of it might be that, that was mom's cure-all for the sore throat or the cold. But a lot of people, like my dad, for example, would take my mom down to Verner's every other Friday while he was dating her before they got married. So Verner's was a destination. When we had streetcars in Detroit, the streetcars went down Woodward and they went all the way around Verner's. It took up an entire city block to head back north up Woodward. So it was a part of everyday life in Detroit. People talk about going on the Boblo boats. Well, every Boblo boat trip started at Verner's or ended at Verner's, because that's what people did. And so it was just parts of people's lives. I hear the dating stories, the marriage proposal stories, all of those kinds of things that happened at Verner's associated with Verner's. So it was part of the culture of Detroit, not just a drink.
I've got one more question. Tell me what a Boston Cooler is, and why is it Boston Cooler?
A Boston Cooler is Verner's and vanilla ice cream mixed like a milkshake. The term actually began in the early days of the soda fountain, when any pop mixed in that way with ice cream would be called a Boston Cooler. So you could have a Heyer's Boston Cooler or a Coke Boston Cooler. Well, Verner's got smart and they trademarked the name, and so then it became only Verner's. But it has nothing to do with Boston, Massachusetts, nothing to do with Boston Boulevard. It's just an old old term from the soda fountain days of ice cream mixed with pot.
Keith Wunderlich is a Verner's memorabilia collector and helped organize the celebration of the 150th anniversary of the iconic Detroit ginger ale. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I had to make a trip on a two-lane highway on one of those recent warm days, and it made me smile as I passed by Dairy Queens and independent ice cream shops because there was a long line at every one of them. Well, the Ludington Daily News reports tomorrow there might be a pretty long line there for ice cream. There might be thousands of people in downtown Ludington with ice cream on their minds. Using ice cream from House of Flavors, Ludington is going to attempt to set a Guinness World Record for the longest ice cream dessert. Joining us is Barry Neal from House of Flavors. How long does it have to be?
It's going to be a half mile long, Lester. Thank you.
That's a lot of ice cream. How much do you have to put together?
You know, it's 900 gallons of ice cream, so we're expecting between 15 and 18,000 scoops, 800 pounds of chocolate syrup, 600 cans of whipped cream, and more than 2,000 cherries to get everybody ready to eat.
Everything and the cherry. So this takes a lot of prep. What have you been doing to get ready for it?
You know, we've been working on this since about the middle of October. I've had some, you know, lots of meetings. You have to actually apply to Guinness in order to be accepted to challenge the record. And then, you know, that once we were accepted, it unleashes a whole bevy of work with the city and the state to close our downtown up. And then just really working with partners who have joined us in helping to make this all possible.
So you've got to have a lot of volunteers to make this. I mean, otherwise, things are melting at one end before you even get it scooped at the other end. So how many people are going to be helping you?
You know, we believe we have about 1,100 people who have already signed up and registered, and we're taking anybody who wants to help is going to be able to help. They don't need to pre-register. Anybody who's just coming into town to eat one of the 18,000 scoops just should line up along the route from Park Street to Harrison Street, right downtown Ludington. Actually starts a block off the beach, so a beautiful area. And they'll wait till they get their Sunday cup and then eat quickly. And then we'll all cheers towards the Sunday route and have a big aerial photograph taken of us celebrating the fact that we've accomplished this.
Well, making thousands of people pretty happy and breaking a world record, that sounds like a pretty good day overall.
You know, being in the ice cream business is a very sweet thing to do. So it's fun, yes.
So why did you want to do this? What made you decide, this is the thing I want to do to make a mark in Ludington?
You know, we are real busy during the summer, and when we hit the fall, we begin to plan what will we do in the next year to challenge ourselves, give back to the community, and just be more fun. How can we have more fun in our business? And 2 years ago, our downtown Ludington marketing director brought this up to me, and I actually told her no. So this particular fall, I must have felt like I was ready for the challenge, and so we sat down and began the process.
That's Barry Neal with House of Flavor in Ludington, where they're going to attempt to set a new Guinness World Record for longest ice cream dessert. Good luck and bon appetit.
Thanks very much.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.